In today's Nutrition and Life episode, I speak with Dr. Michael Mesh from Barbell Rehab. Michael and I speak about how he helps personal trainers better navigate their clients' pain, why a weak core is not necessarily the cause of low back pain, and his strength rehab certification. I'm excited for you to listen to my conversation with Michael, and please, if you enjoy the show, subscribe and give us a rating or take a screenshot and share the episode on your social media. Thank you so much. Now on to my conversation with Michael. Hello and welcome back to the Nutrition and Life podcast. My name is Lisa, I'm your host, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Michael Mesh from Barbell Rehab. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks, Lisa. I'm excited to see what we're going to dig into today.
Absolutely, me too. But before we talk about all things strength training and rehabilitation, I would love to hear a little bit about you and how you got to where you are today professionally and just in general.
Yeah, for sure. This goes way back to high school, actually, where I was actually a high school baseball player, a pitcher who injured his shoulder and found out that strength training was the key to essentially rehabbing. So the whole way back to age 15, where I was fortunate enough to have an athletic trainer back there in high school who said, okay, shoulder hurts, let's start doing some deadlifts. And at the time I was like, what? Well, how's that going to help my shoulder? Little did I know that general strength trumps all, right? When it really comes down to it. So what ended up happening was I fell in love more with lifting weights than baseball. And that's what led me to pursue a career of physical therapy. So I went into physical therapy school with this idea that I am going to implement strength and conditioning principles into physical therapy. And now 10 years later, here we are, where I'm running Barbell Rehab, which is dedicated to helping personal trainers and physical therapists navigate pain and strength training. So it's been a long way, and I'm super excited to where it's turned into.
Amazing. And yeah, nowadays we were just chatting before recording that you even have a certification, which we're going to talk about a little bit as well. But I love the slogan or the motto that strength training is rehabilitation. And I mean, The amount of times we hear, I can't do anything, my knee hurts, or do anything, my lower back hurts, or all these things. So yeah, I am very excited to talk about how we can bridge fitness and rehabilitation. If you don't mind, as we get into it, would you be able to kind of categorize for us what is actually chronic pain and what's more acute pain?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can do that. You want to start there?
Yeah, please. That would be great.
Sweet. Yeah. So if we look at the book definition, chronic pain is going to pretty much be pain that lingers longer than 3 months. So any kind of pain that is 3 months or that is before 3 months is going to be acute pain. And it really comes down to how do we manage it specifically from a strength training and rehab perspective. And there's so much nuance around this, but when we're really looking at it, if something is hot, flared up, in recent, like an acute injury within 3 months, that's where we're going to be more or less training around things and trying to make things as pain-free as possible to kind of simmer the whole system down so that we can build back up. Once we start to get into the chronic pain side of things, that's where things start to get a little tricky, because the longer an injury lingers, the less connected it is to physical tissue damage. So if you're working with somebody that's had back pain for 10 years, shoulder pain for 10 years, that's going to be a lot different management than somebody who tweaked their shoulder 2 weeks ago. Once we start to get into chronic pain, that's where we're going to start to nudge and maybe push through a little bit of pain to see if we can force some adaptations. Cautiously, of course, right? But it always comes down to tolerability and knowing where is this person at? Did they just tweak their back, or have they had back pain for 15 years?
Very interesting. And it reminds me of a paper that I read with my research group a few months ago where they were talking about chronic pain and how over time it's actually almost more mental, because we are then suddenly afraid of certain movements, or our body has gotten into this adaptive sort of pattern where we then just like use one side more than the other, or just generally like we're almost bracing ourselves too much and not actually going through the movement anymore. So I'm sure we'll talk more about that soon as well. But going back to the point of the low back pain, one of the most common things you probably hear, for example, I can't deadlift anymore because I have something with my lower back or something like that. That's probably, I would assume, something you hear quite frequently. Can you explain to us what's sort of wrong with this statement and why it probably isn't like down to a particular movement that someone has a particular pain?
Yeah, for sure. It really comes down to if we MRI'd 100 people in their 30s or 40s, most people are going to have, quote unquote, something going on in their back. I think if we look at the stats, 50% of 40-year-olds without low back pain have at least one bulging disc. So these things are super duper common. So we really can't go by what MRIs say because it's just a picture on the inside. We have to go by how somebody feels, how somebody moves, and what their goals are. And that often leads to the question of, well, I have a herniated insert, herniated disc, or bulging disc, or sciatica. If I strength train, will it make it worse? Right. And the fact of the matter is, if you're a personal trainer listening to this, assume that the majority of your people, if you MRI'd them, they would have something in their back. And I always say that what we know will make it worse for sure is not moving, is not loading. So to me, the risk of sustaining a back tweak is far less than the risk of some of these nastier things later in life that we see from not strength training, right? So for me, it's a risk that I'm willing to take as long as we are using sound programming. Listening to the client, gathering feedback, and ensuring that everything is tolerable. So, back injuries are not red flags to strength training. There's only a couple things that, like, if somebody is having trouble with bowel and bladder control, or now we're looking into like leg numbness, or somebody can't feel their legs. Of course, that's when the little red light in your brain should go off and be like, maybe I shouldn't work with this person today. But outside of red flag symptoms, one of the best things for back pain is just staying moving with intolerable patterns.
Yeah, I can attest to that from a personal perspective. I used to have some issue with my sciatic nerve more and probably other things associated with that because as you say, it's normally not one particular thing. It probably comes down to more. What always made me feel better was just keeping on moving. Or even nowadays, if I sit for a very long amount of time, like for instance, really long distance travel or so, that's when it gets re-aggravated. But if I keep moving, if I keep sort of, yeah, keep it smooth, then normally I don't experience any pain. Oftentimes people also think that low back pain comes down to having a weak core. Is there any truth to that?
Well, that's what I learned 10, 15 years ago in physical therapy school, but there's very limited truth to that, if any. So I'm a big proponent of teaching that core weakness does not really equal back pain because that can actually end up doing more harm than good. Because if you take somebody with back pain and you tell them, well, you have a weak core, well, now we can lead to, that can lead to what's called a nocebo effect, where they are now feeling more fragile. And if you tell somebody they're in pain because they're weak, it's going to potentially make them hesitant to move and get stronger because I don't want to break things further. So I'm actually a big fan of staying away from that narrative of core weakness is leading to back pain, but we don't want to swing the pendulum so far because I'm still going to prescribe back strengthening drills, not because the weakness is causing their pain, but building back strength is good in general. So it's sort of that causation correlation type of thing.
Yeah, and what I have sometimes seen is that when people think, oh, I have a weak core, I need to do crunches or I need to do sit-ups or whatever. And then it can actually, in my experience or opinion, make things worse. If, especially if you have a bulging disc, I mean, you don't really necessarily know, but I personally think things like planks or more like isometric or lengthening or exercises per se could potentially be more helpful. Am I right in that thinking?
Yeah, what it really comes down to though is if it's tolerable. I used to like be on the idea of like no crunches for back pain, but there's different types of back pain. If somebody is more if we dichotomize back pain into flexion and extension sensitivities, meaning flexion sensitive would mean if I bend forward, it hurts my back. Extension sensitive means if I bend backward, it hurts my back. So if somebody is flexion insensitive, meaning forward bending hurts, then I would not be doing any kind of sit-ups or crunches. But if somebody is more extension sensitive, where bending backward hurts, but bending forward feels good, I might not be doing some crunches might be more applicable in that situation. For back pain specifically, what really comes down to it is we want it to be comfortable and we want it to be tolerable so that they can start to build up some sense of like small wins where they're no longer feeling fragile and we're starting to feel more resilient. And something that you alluded to earlier in the podcast was that when we look at people with chronic back pain, they actually move more rigidly, right? So they're moving tighter. They're moving with their abs essentially tensed all day, like a clenched fist, in fear mode because my back hurts. And what do we do when something hurts? We contract it to protect it. So I found that sometimes for people with chronic low back pain, if we just pile on a bunch of core stability work, it can actually exacerbate things by reinforcing this idea of I need to stay tight, 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 when in fact they need the opposite. They need to learn how to take deep breath and release that tension and move more fluidly. So there's a lot of interesting stuff when it comes to chronic back pain and navigating those waters.
Very interesting. Yeah, so perhaps also even things like, well, I mean, any kind of relaxation exercise, but also things like going to the sauna from time to time to learn to let go, and heat treatment in general could be helpful, perhaps.
100%, because once, as you again alluded to, once we start to get to that chronic pain, pain is always influenced by psychological, sociological, and biomechanical variables. The more that we become into the chronic state, the more the psychological and sociological matters. And what we have to be careful in saying is that when I say this, if somebody misinterprets it, they might say, oh, you're just telling me my pain's all in my head or my pain's, of course it's not. Anytime, and that's something I really want to emphasize here, when somebody is experiencing pain, it's real. It's real to them. It's absolutely real. But the problem is, as the longer it lingers, the more your mindset influences the changes in pain. So anything that promotes relaxation for somebody with chronic low back pain, whether that be heat, sauna, massage, yoga, anything that is essentially calming the system down, promoting more of that parasympathetic response is what we're really looking for when it comes to chronic pain.
Really great tip. And speaking of tips, you have wonderful information on your Instagram page as well, as I was preparing for this episode. And I assume that many of the tips that you share on there are similar to what you're going to go more into detail with your certification as well. But for example, one thing that was sort of saying, hey, trainer, just keep in mind that any injury is not necessarily due to just that. It could be an accumulation of poor sleep over time, poor sitting patterns at work over time, poor, like literally anything at work, or what other things could be causing an injury over time.
For sure. And yeah, so that's where we like to say pain is multifactorial, right? It's a lot easier and a lot cleaner to be like, you hurt because of this one reason. And if we fix this one reason, you'll get better. That's in a perfect world. But we know that there are so many different factors that can influence pain. And when people hear this, they can sometimes get a little bit discouraged. They'll be like, well, if there's so many things that are affecting my pain, where do I start? And I try and flip the script there and say, hey, now we have multiple avenues of attack, right? If your pain is influenced by, okay, you're sitting too long, you're stressed out at work, you're not getting enough exercise, you're not eating well, you're not drinking enough. Now there's a bunch of different avenues we can attack here to really get after it. So I think it's an empowering thing that pain's multifactorial.
That's a really great point. And again, I have a personal anecdote to this because about 10 years ago or so, I was working shift work, so sleeping very little. On top of that, I was training twice a day, many days of the week. So way too much, way too hard intensity, not recovering well. And the only thing I really had going for me was that I probably ate sufficiently or ate enough and enough protein as well. But lo and behold, I had a neck injury. I had something with my wrist and then piling on some pain in my lower back as well. So, yeah, it was not just like one movement or overtraining one day or one week. It was just like, I now know that my body was no longer able to deal with it. And I think it's so impressive because our bodies, they're really so resilient and adaptive over time, and that's of course a good thing, but unfortunately there's going to be a point where the body just says, I've had enough and I can't take anymore. I'm gonna like yeah this is where the injury or the sickness or something like that comes out. But yeah, aside from the lower back pain, as I mentioned earlier, I at least the people that I deal with, also several have knee issues or ankle issues, and so sometimes I hear, oh, I can't do any cardio at all. I can't walk or can't run or so, because I have this thing with my knee. And then I again also saw something on your content where it said, well, people try to run 5 miles and then they say, I can't run anymore because my knee hurts. But then they don't ease back into things and don't just try like, hey, did it hurt after 1 mile or after a mile and a half? They usually go for too much. Is that a pattern that you see quite frequently?
100%. Yeah. So when I started Barbell Rehab, I was dead set on pain was a result of poor form. So one of the first questions I used to ask people was, well, let me see a video of your form and I'll tell you why you have back pain during the deadlift, or show me your squat and I'll tell you why you have knee pain during squats, right? But now we know that it's much more related to the dosage, right? Doing too much, too fast, too soon. So don't blame the exercise. Look at the application of it. Look at what was going on in your personal life during that month. One of my personal anecdotes was in physical therapy school, it seemed like I would always tweak my back during finals week. And I was so sure it was like, I just need to have more core stability. I need to have better form. So I just added planks upon planks upon planks. And now I look back and I just realized, well, you were super stressed out every finals week. You didn't sleep well, you didn't eat well. And then you decided that you're going to try and do a one rep max and wonder why you hurt yourself. It wasn't because of poor form, it was everything else going on, right? And that was just the straw that broke the camel's back, for lack of better terminology.
Yeah, I think it's so important, or auto-regulation can be such a great thing if we learn to be in tune with our body and what the body needs at the time. So, for example, with your finals week, saying then, okay, I'm actually going to use this as a deload week, or maybe just do something like just go for a walk on a day where I feel particularly stressed, or maybe go in and do some machine isolation work where the injury risk is like super minimal, perhaps. And then other weeks when you have a semester break or so and you're very well slept and you don't have anything else on your mind, you can attempt your one rep maxes all day long.
Yeah, for sure. That's why I really love autoregulation and using RPE, especially for pain, right? It's in the performance world to increase strength and hypertrophy, but I use it extensively in the pain world as well to promote tolerability.
Awesome. So what other tips would you have for personal trainers that might be listening that are working remotely and yeah, are just maybe struggling to even have that security of like, am I prescribing something my client shouldn't be doing, or my client saying they're having a little bit of pain here and there, but they want to work on their posture? Just some general tips that could be helpful.
One of them is going to be never underestimate the ability of small form tweaks to cause drastic reductions in pain. You can have somebody that has 10 out of 10 hip pain at the bottom of a squat, but by simply changing their stance, by adjusting how wide they stand and by adjusting how much foot flare they have, you can take that 10 out of 10 pain and completely eradicate it. Same thing for like pressing patterns. If somebody's having shoulder pain with a dumbbell bench or a barbell bench, simply adjusting where their shoulder angle is, whether they flare more or they tuck more, can drastically change the pain experience. So if you're a personal trainer working remotely with clients, getting some video feedback can go a long way for when somebody says, well, I have shoulder pain when I'm benching, then you can make the recommendation, well, instead of stopping altogether, why don't you try close grip bench this week? Or why don't we try dumbbell bench? What I like to say is there's usually a way to continue training in the presence of pain safely, but we don't usually have to scrap everything altogether. Sometimes it just takes small adjustments. So that's probably my biggest tip. And if they can't do that exercise, find something that they can do. And that's where, as a personal trainer, knowing like your progressions and regressions can go a long way. If somebody can't back squat, can they front squat? Can they goblet squat? Can they do a supported squat? Right. When I was working in the clinic, I did 3, 4 years full time in the clinic. A lot of the people I worked with were older, deconditioned, and I was having every single person like do squats, right? Because it's something that's so imperative to life. But we were just getting creative of like, hey, this person needs to do a squat from a chair with 2 AirX pads on it, right? Because that's their entry point. After a couple of weeks, we take an AirX pad away. So now they have 2 to 3 more inches of depth. So it really comes down to meeting people where they're at, finding entry points to movement, and then progressing from there.
That's really, really helpful. And I think, unfortunately, often when we talk to people, they might have some, as you kind of alluded to earlier, with the nocebo or placebo things. They probably have like a preconceived something in their head. For example, my dad had a bicycle injury, and something with his knee happened. He had to have surgery, and the doctor unfortunately told him he should never ever squat again. Because but and I was just like pulling my hands over my head. And unfortunately, my dad is of the generation where as soon as someone has a white coat on, they're like God, and everything that they say is true. And so of course it doesn't matter when I get there. I'm like, okay, well, can we try with the chair or something like that? Because then also he had his belief sort of reinforced, because the next day it was like a little bit sore just breaking through the scar tissue, and of course a movement he hadn't done in a long time, and he took that as, oh, that's pain, of course that's bad, I shouldn't be doing that, so I'm not going to listen to Lisa anymore. The doctor was right all the way. So unfortunately, I think with some people, we, especially with the daughter, probably even less likely to listen. But yeah, I could imagine you encounter some pre-existing limiting sort of beliefs as well.
Yeah, for sure. And it's tough because there's multiple things going on here. Sometimes docs just write no squats, and that's like just what the script says. But there's like no like forever. Like what does that actually mean? So myself and my instructors have really talked about this, and we asked each other the question of like, is there ever such thing as a lifelong contraindication to squats and deadlifts? And we racked our brains, and like outside of like severe situations like spinal cord injury or things like that, if you're a human capable of bending over to pick things up and sitting down in a chair, you're already doing these things, right? So don't get me wrong. If somebody just had a knee surgery, if somebody just had a back surgery, there will be temporary contraindications to these movements. But the key word is temporary. If they want to get back to life and being able to engage with their environment, then we for sure want to redose these things in. Am I going to put somebody with a knee replacement 4 weeks out under a 1 rep max low bar squat? No. Am I going to have them hold on to a TRX and do an assisted squat to a depth that is comfortable to them? Absolutely. So that's what it really comes down to. And being a personal trainer, this can be tough because for those listening, you never want to disobey doctor's orders, right? That can get sketchy, but you can reframe things. The first thing I would ask is like, how long ago was this surgery? Oh, 2 years ago. Okay. Well, then this person's okay to squat. And you can just flip the verbiage. You can say, okay, we won't do squats, but today we'll just try something called a kettlebell sit to stand, right? So it's just a reframe of the verbiage, because when it comes down to it, some people just hear the word squat or they hear the word deadlift and it's a fear response automatically set off. So reframing these is like, oh, that we're just going to do something called a kettlebell hinge or a goblet sit to stand, right? That can kind of dampen the fear associated around them.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And I think as well, sometimes people really, if they haven't used a muscle or a movement, gone through a movement pattern in such a long time, again, they're going to be a little bit sore, or it's going to feel uncomfortable no matter what. And so maybe talking to them beforehand or at the time about like, hey, listen, you haven't gone to this depth in I don't know how many years. So it could be that tomorrow it feels a little bit different. Would that be a feasible approach?
Yeah, for sure. So that's the age-old question of how can I tell if it's like delayed onset muscle soreness or if I tweaked something. One thing I like to do is do everything, make sure you're doing everything bilaterally. Well, not necessarily bilaterally. You can do unilateral too, but both sides. And for example, let's say somebody it comes in with knee pain, okay? And you have them do squats, leg press, lunges, what have you. And then the next day, both legs are equally sore. We're looking at muscle soreness, right? But if they come in the next day and their non-affected leg is not sore at all, and their affected leg is really, really sore, now we might be looking into something of like, okay, maybe we agitated things a little bit. So I always like to say, can we compare side to side, right? Everybody knows that if you've not done RDLs for a while or some sort of slow hinge, if you do them, it's going to make your hamstrings sore and you're going to have soreness for a couple days. But there shouldn't be a huge difference from side to side, right? So that's one thing I do look at. And making sure we're clearing red flags, making sure clients are not saying things like stinging, burning, stabbing, numbness, buckling. As long as they're not saying those words and they're using, if you ask them to explain it and they're saying things more like dull, achy, then you know you're probably okay. So that's how I like to use like a green light, yellow light, red light approach to trying to understand what they're explaining to me.
Okay, yeah, that sounds very logical. And with that, would you also sometimes advise for like anti-inflammatory creams or cold, just a cold wrap or something like that? If someone does say like, hey, it is a little bit sore, or I haven't gone through this movement pattern, like it, in the sense of helping the inflammation go down, if there is any.
I'm not usually recommending any kind of medication just because I don't really want to go down that route. But if it's something that they recommend where they're like, hey, do you think I can try Icy Hot or Biofreeze for this? Well, yeah, sure. But it's not something I'm usually recommending from my end because it's one of those things of if we zone out and look months down the road, whether they used Icy Hot or not, it's not going to influence the long-term goal. And I don't want them to think that they need it to get better. But if somebody is suggesting it on their end, then it's more or less, yeah, sure. I just don't think we need to put too much stock in the effect of those modalities.
That makes absolute sense. And yeah, Michael, if you would like, or if you'd be able to give us a little bit of an outline of your certification in the sense of how long it takes, what the categories are or modules within, so to speak. Yeah, that would be great.
For sure. So I created the course in April of 2021, and we've now taught 160 of them across the country and four other countries as well. So it took off. I was super excited about it because the mission behind it back when I was creating it in late 2020 was this idea of I identified a gap. I knew that there was a lot of physical therapists that didn't know a lot about lifting weights. And then there was a lot of personal trainers who didn't know a lot about pain. So I said, hey, let's get everybody in the same room and let's teach one comprehensive course for both fitness and rehab professionals to teach everybody how to manage clients in pain, with the hope that if you're a physical therapist, you bring your rehab knowledge into the course and now you learn about lifting. And if you're a personal trainer, you bring the lifting knowledge into the course and now you learn about rehab so that we keep more people moving. So basically what we do is it's a 2-day course, 15 hours, 7.5 hours each day, where day one is basically all upper body and day one is all lower body, where we're going through all of the basic compound lifts, how to coach them and how to modify them for pain. So day one, basically we're covering barbell bench press, dumbbell bench press, overhead press, landmine press, and rowing variations. And it's all built on our 4-step framework for training with pain. Everything is built around that. So basically, step one is if somebody's having pain with a lift, let's first look at technique and programming. Is the technique decent and are they doing too much too fast too soon? Okay. A lot of pain can be simmered down just by those two adjustments. Step two would be, hey, let's take the lift and make these small adjustments to it. Let's adjust grip width during the bench press. Let's adjust foot flare during the squat. Step three would be, if those small adjustments don't work, let's take that exercise out completely and find something else that works. Can't do a deadlift? Let's try a cable pull through. Let's try a glute bridge, right? Some sort of way to train those muscles in a tolerable fashion. And then step four would be, if it's the client's goal, let's reintroduce that once painful lift and build capacity. So that's basically our whole course is built on that. And then on day two, we go through that model with the squat, deadlift, and lunge, with the goal of after you leave this course, you will feel much more comfortable coaching clients who have aches and pains and empowering them to work around them. And at the same point, you're also going to decrease pain by working around them. So that's what it really comes down to. It's the Barbell Rehab Method certification. We teach about 50 of them a year around the United States. I have a team of seven instructors who go fly around the United States and teach this, and I'm very fortunate to be able to do this.
That's amazing. I even just love the name because it literally says what you're trying to do. You're rehabbing people with a strength training. And just a follow-up question on that as well. So of course people go away after these 2 days and they have a lot of knowledge, but I assume that throughout their working days in the following weeks, maybe new questions arise, or they of course try to apply it. And as we all know, not necessarily the first time around that we apply something, we're successful with it, or maybe even more questions come up. So after that, can they reach out to your team and have sort of like, is that sort of like a mentorship if they need it, or not really?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So we give everybody access to our private Facebook group after, where I encourage people, after you take the course, the last thing I want to do is just take your money and run, right? I want to help you. So we encourage people, if you have questions about how to use this framework or this method, post in our Facebook group and one of our instructors will get back to you. And we're working on improving the flow of that so that people can get the support they need. But yeah, that's something we're very proud of, to make sure that, and everybody gets a hard copy manual too, so that they can take this with them and refer back to it when they're working out on the gym floor.
Yeah, that's super cool because I mean, in the application, that's essentially where we manifest, or where we really ingrain the knowledge. Then it's all well and good doing it once with other people that are sort of in the same boat. But then if you work with someone who's 300 pounds and's had two big injuries and so on, suddenly might look a little bit different. So yeah, I think that's really great that they continue to have the support there. And I have a somewhat selfish question because I have noticed that one of my hips, also due to my sciatic nerve thingy, it still drops a little bit more than the other one during squats, something I'm very mindful of. I try to do like unilateral stuff to kind of balance that out and strengthen that weaker side. But I'd be curious, what would be your approach, or what would be your favorite lunge or exercise variations in order to kind of help achieve that stability?
So let me try my best to answer this within a couple minutes, because like this is a very nuanced question, but it's something we cover in the course actually. So when we look at asymmetries during squats, whether that's a hip shift to the left or right, whether that's a butt wink or some sort of something wonky going on, we need to decide, is that a problem or not, right? And it's not a black and white answer. Some things that I like to look at is there pain? If there's pain, then it's obviously something we want to change. Pain is always basically a push for change. But if there's no pain, then you wonder, well, if I squat like this, is it going to cause pain or am I okay? So the next thing we would look at is, if there's no pain, is it a stable asymmetry? Meaning, do you shift worse, or does the asymmetry get worse as you add more load? And if the answer is yes, then that's something we want to scale back. So let's say somebody has a minor hip shift when they're at 50% RM, but then it turns into a massive hip shift when they're at RPE 9 or the higher percentages. Well, then that's not something we want to push through. That's where something we want to work more on single leg work so that we can start to tease things out. But if it's more of a stable symmetry, meaning every time you squat, whether it's a body weight, whether it's 50% RM, whether it's 90% RM, let's say it shifts the same amount, it's consistent, and there's no pain, I am less likely to intervene on that because to me, that is something that person has adapted to. As long as there is also some single leg work in the program. That's the best way I like to look at asymmetries is asking that question, the two questions of, is there pain and is it stable? And if the answer is yes, it's stable, no, there's no pain, I'm less likely to intervene. Does that make sense?
That makes absolute sense because I guess that would be sort of like changing someone's squat stance, even though they're like comfortable, and just because you think a textbook says something different, and sometimes we might actually make things worse if we then try and quote unquote optimize it, although it's their own personal way to go about it. But yeah, so in the instance of the shift gets worse with load. So in my example, the right glute is also very or a lot less developed than the left one, and I have a harder time establishing a mind muscle connection to that side. So what would be some exercises to implement in that case?
Yeah, for sure. So that's where like a good warm up can really play in, where you're doing some single leg glute bridges, some bird dogs or quadruped kickbacks, anything to just help like get some blood into that muscle and improve that mind muscle connection before squatting, but not being fearful of squatting at the same time, right? Taking your squats, slowing it down, tempo squats work very well. And moving up to a load where you're challenging yourself enough, but not so much that form is completely breaking down and things are getting wonky. So my two things would be tempo and a good warm up.
Awesome. Yeah, and tempo has definitely worked a lot for me, especially kind of like holding at the bottom or taking it only as low until I can actually feel that muscle being engaged, because I'm used to like bouncing out of the bottom from CrossFit, where you just like you completely lose control and you just use the stretch reflex circle or whatever. But essentially, not going all that deep and just going slowly as deep as I am able to hold that connection and then driving it up slower. That's definitely been very beneficial for me. But I'm gonna go a little bit deeper on the warm-ups. That's a very good tip. Thank
Yeah,
you
for sure.
for
And
that.
like, you're welcome. And what it really comes down to is, are we moving? Are we loading? Right? Everybody has different anatomies. Everybody has different hip anatomy. Everybody has different goals and different, like what they want to get out of lifting. So we wouldn't expect everybody's squat to look the same, right? So that's where it really comes down, in the course we teach is like everybody is going to be built differently, but everybody can strength train, right? There is something that you can do. The goal of a personal trainer is finding what that something is, right? And where to start.
Really great point, and adapting it to the client's goal, whether it's longevity or performance or aesthetics, et cetera. So super cool. Thank you so much, Michael. This has been a really insightful conversation. I will make sure to put all your links in the show notes and the link to the certification as well. I think everyone who is somewhere in the space of personal training or physiotherapy should absolutely take a look at it. And just thank you for your time. It's been a true pleasure.
Yeah, I appreciate you having me on, Lisa.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael. Thank you so much for tuning in. Go and give us both a follow on Instagram or YouTube. One more thing before you go, if you are looking for premium supplements, our partner Fat Muscle Project has got you covered. Head to their website for the best protein powders, creatine, vitamin D, and more. And feel free to use our code NCL at the checkout. Thank you for listening, and don't forget, life is too short to be in a body you don't feel good in.